Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, we like to think of evolution as an optimization process. We talk about survival of the fittest. But if that's true, how come after generations of evolution, genetic mutations still persist? Dr. Lara Dergovich is a biological anthropologist. She joins me now to explore that very question. Lara, you're very welcome to the program. Perhaps you might start off by telling us a little bit about how you became interested in this whole idea.
Sure. I was teaching a class in evolutionary medicine at Harvard University, and evolutionary medicine as a field is relatively new. It's a few decades old and explores this idea of why human bodies aren't more optimized. And I had been familiar with the tenets of the course, but the field, but the more that I explored it, the more that I read about it, the more connections I found to my own personal health and my own personal history. And I became especially interested in the question of genetic diseases because when I was pregnant with my daughter, I discovered that I'm a carrier of a gene for a disease called Tay-Sachs, which is a neurological disorder that has no cure. And based on classic tenets of Darwinian evolution, we would have expected it to have gotten weeded out of the population at some point, given that it's a fatal disease, and it hasn't. And more particularly, it is found at unusually high concentrations in certain segments of the population, particularly among Ashkenazi Jews. And so I became interested in the question, given that I'm a carrier of this disease, of why it's still around. And I discovered that there is a connection between carriers for Tay-Sachs and having an increased resistance to tuberculosis.
So I want to go into that in a bit, but I wanted to go back to something you said at the beginning. You said why is the human body not better optimized? And I thought we were. What made you say that? Why are people thinking that human beings aren't extremely well optimized for their environment?
We are in a lot of senses. And I think one really good way to try to think about that question is to go back to something you said in your introduction about survival of the fittest. And what most people hear when they hear survival of the fittest is kind of an absolute measurement. And from an evolutionary perspective, that's not really what survival of the fittest means, because the fittest refers to who is the most likely to survive and reproduce in a particular environment. And so the fact that the fittest is tied to environmental change means that there is no one optimum for evolution to reach, for natural selection to aim for. Anytime the environment changes, the definition of who is the fittest within a population can also change. And so in many ways, humans are optimized to our environment in a broad sense. But evolutionary change also has constraints in terms of having to work with the materials that are available, not being able to start from scratch. Every time you have an environmental change, you have to kind of jury-rig the existing physiology, the existing anatomy, in order to make it work within the framework that you already have. And also, most people don't think about the fact that when we talk about natural selection, it's not optimizing for health in particular. It's optimizing to maximize reproductive success. And so in some instances, there can be characteristics that can be either neutral or potentially even harmful to an individual in the long run. But if in the short run, they improve an individual's odds of mating and reproducing, then natural selection is still going to favor those characteristics. So there's a variety of reasons why, even though human bodies do function very well in our environments for the most part, they don't function better. We still have problems, not only in terms of, or challenges, I should say, not only in terms of the genetic legacies we carry, but also in terms of our anatomy, for example, We evolved into bipedal walkers from being from quadrupedal ancestors, and the changes associated with that have left us susceptible to lower back pain and knee injuries and things like that. And if you were to design a bipedal walker from scratch, you might have engineered people in such a way as to try to avoid those kinds of problems.
You mentioned that Tay-Sachs, which is common in some populations, particularly the Ashkenazi Jewish population, has obviously the downside of being potentially this extremely serious disease that can be passed down through generations if two copies of the allele or the version of the gene that's problematic are found in a child, right? But
correct.
One version of those genes may be useful. And this is what got you thinking about TB.
Exactly. Well, it didn't get me thinking about TB specifically, but it got people who preceded me thinking about TB in connection with Tay-Sachs. What appears to be going on is a phenomenon that's known as heterozygote advantage, which means that if you carry one copy, one dominant version of the gene, and then also one of the recessive versions of the gene, which is in the case of Tay-Sachs, the problematic version, that is somehow a better genetic combination, again, in a particular environment, than if you have two copies of the dominant gene or two copies of the recessive gene, which, again, in the case of Tay-Sachs, would be fatal. And a lot of people actually are somewhat familiar with the concept of heterozygote advantage, even if they don't know it, because it is the same thing that's going on in terms of the relationship between sickle cell anemia and malaria. In certain environments where malaria is found at higher frequencies, because that's where the malarial parasite is transmitted by mosquitoes, it turns out that having one copy of the gene for sickle cell anemia is protective against malaria. And it appears that the same relationship holds true for Tay-Sachs and tuberculosis. There seems to have been historically a selective pressure, a circumstances in which natural selection favored the retention of this recessive gene in Ashkenazi Jewish populations in particular, because of cultural and historical circumstances that made TB a higher risk within those populations.
When we talk about sickle cell as another example of this, this benefit that's passed on by having one potentially very dangerous gene, mm-hmm. How does that work exactly? How can having sickle cell make you more resistant to malaria?
In that particular case, sickle cell ends up being, having one copy of the sickle cell gene, it ends up being beneficial because it changes the shape of some of your red blood cells. And the malarial parasite can only reproduce and complete its life cycle in normally shaped red blood cells. So by reducing the proportion of red blood cells that are susceptible to the malarial parasite, it increases the resistance to malaria.
Right. And then for Tay-Sachs, which you were a carrier for, mm-hmm. what is the relationship between that and TB?
It's a more complicated molecular relationship, and it's only been discovered more recently, but the short version is that the Tay-Sachs allele also reduces the likelihood of the negative effects of TB from influencing an individual. So it has to do with aspects of mucus buildup and things like that. It's a much more complicated biochemical mechanism. Researchers have recently established that there is a firm connection. So this connection was hypothesized initially quite some time ago, but there was no mechanism identified, and they've more recently identified an actual mechanism for it.
When we think of the potential damage that one of these alleles, one of these faulty genes, can have to offspring, whether it's Tay-Sachs or sickle cell, surely that's such a negative pressure that it shouldn't persist in a population, you would think. Why do we think that these single cell mutations that can be so damaging survive for so long?
Again, it has to do simply with the relative benefit of that genetic makeup in a particular environment. So if there is an environment where, in the case of sickle cell anemia, malaria was not particularly threatening, or tuberculosis was not particularly threatening for the Tay-Sachs gene, then you absolutely do see that gene get weeded out. And that's why rates of those of carriers in non-vulnerable populations are so much lower. But if you are in an environment where one of these things is a particular threat, where the likelihood of death due to malaria or the likelihood of death due to tuberculosis is particularly high, then from a genetic perspective, it actually, it's a cost-benefit analysis, and natural selection determines that there is actually the benefit outweighs the cost. And so if we're talking about Tay-Sachs, then we can say that the likelihood of inheriting two of those recessive alleles is lower than the likelihood of dying from tuberculosis. And so it's...
Really? Yeah. Tuberculosis where?
So in different periods of time. So what right. What I have particularly highlighted when I've talked about the relationship between Tay-Sachs and tuberculosis is within the Ashkenazi Jewish population, there are both historical and cultural factors that seem to have been in play here. Historical factors in the sense of Jews often having been confined within ghettos and having limited ability to physically escape an environment where tuberculosis might be rampant, and cultural factors in the sense of Jews being more likely to marry other Jews, and that can amplify the frequency of a recessive gene. So it really all is dependent on the environment that you're looking at, and if the threats of the environment in terms of one of these infectious diseases is high enough, then that can drive natural selection to maintain these recessive alleles.
What about something like nearsightedness? Is this a possible similar shift in adaptation to our environment that in some cases might be seen as a deficit, but actually might confer advantage somewhere else?
Probably not. Nearsightedness is more likely a result of what, again, in the field of evolutionary medicine would be termed mismatch. And what that refers to is the fact that most humans today live in environments that are not particularly similar to the environments that we evolved in as a species over the last 100,000 or 200,000 years. So when we look at something like nearsightedness, what the evidence seems to suggest is that a change in the way that we are using our eyes on a day-to-day basis has actually affected, or can actually affect, the shape of an individual's eye and therefore the function of an individual's eye. So if you think about the ways or the behaviors that somebody in a hunter-gatherer population would have been, what they would have been doing 100,000 years ago, they're on the, African savanna, they're looking at these enormous landscapes and
trying to look for a prey or somewhere safe or constantly on the move, need a broad horizon, need long distance sight.
Exactly. What you're not doing at that time is sitting in front of a computer screen or reading a book or any of the things that many people today spend most of their time doing. And so what we've seen is that as the frequency of what is termed near work, or using your eyes for staring at a computer screen or reading a book, has increased in populations, the rate of nearsightedness has also increased. And they actually have shown that that is a result of changes to the shape of the eye that are derived from this constant focus on near objects. And so that's a good example of this phenomenon of environmental mismatch or evolutionary mismatch, which may actually explain a lot of challenges that humans in modern populations deal with. Their mismatch probably contributes to things like obesity and diabetes and a variety of other chronic health conditions that humans have.
What is the future then, as you see it, Lara? Will we be giving genetic corrections to people via injection, stem cell, pills? Is that the dream of the future, that if we see potentially faulty genetic diseases, that we may somehow be able to alter those using CRISPR or other sorts of technologies?
Sure. I think that there are certainly possibilities that can be explored in that direction. It is, for me personally, and for most geneticists or biologists, it gets to be a very tricky question in terms of editing germline cells. But if you're talking about being able to make genetic changes just within the somatic cell lines of an individual that might be able to cure or ameliorate the symptoms of a particular disease, then I think that those practices have a lot of promise. But generally speaking, I think within evolutionary medicine, the perspective is more often preventative in measure. It's a question of knowing about humans' evolutionary past as a species, and then for individuals, understanding your own genetic, ethnic, cultural background, and recognizing how that affects you as an individual in terms of making you more likely to suffer from certain health problems. And once you know that, there are potentially simpler behavioral kinds of interventions that you can take to reduce the likelihood of those problems affecting you. So I think that evolutionary medicine is a broader way of thinking about health and understanding that what's affecting an individual's health on a day-to-day basis is interrelated with that individual's broader background and history.
Well, Dr. Lara Dergovich, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been fun.